The preacher must be in earnest. Earnestness, the sine qua non for the preacher. The preacher must be in earnest, not should be. Take John Angel James, who devoted an entire volume to the subject, calling it an earnest ministry, the want of the times. We listen to one preacher whose excellent composition and sonorous, perhaps even musical voice, command our admiration, but not a passion stirs. All within is cold, quiet, and without emotion. The speaking is good, but it does not move us. But there is another, with perhaps less talent, but his tones, his looks, his manner throughout are full of earnest feeling. He then turned his sights on the hearers. Who is likely to be moved by hearing a man discuss the most awful realities of eternal truth, the glories of heaven and the torments of hell, with as much coolness and with as little emotion as a lecturer on science would exhibit when dwelling on the facts of natural history? Is it probable there can be any earnestness in the hearer when there is none in the preacher? The conclusion? A want of earnestness in the execution of that commission which is designed to save immortal souls from eternal ruin and to raise them to everlasting life is a spectacle which, if it were not so common, would fill us with amazement, indignation, and contempt. If that was true in 1848, how much more so today? So what is earnestness? James again. This is earnestness in preaching, when it is evident to the hearer that the preacher feels the truths he discusses, when it is manifest to all that he believes what he says, in affirming that his hearers are sinking into perdition, and that he is laboring to persuade them to forsake their evil courses, when his sermons are full of close, pointed, personal addresses, when, in short, through the whole discourse, the preacher is seen moving onward from the understanding to a closer and closer approximation to the heart in conclusion. And the hearer feels at length the hand of the preacher seizing him with a mysterious and resistless power and bearing him away, almost whether he will or not, to Christ and salvation and heaven. The conviction of the judgment is not the ultimate object of good preaching, though if we are to judge by their manner of preaching, it is the chief, if not the exclusive, end of some preachers. But they ought to know the persuasion of the heart does not follow as a matter of course. This has still to be effected, and they have yet to undertake it as a distinct purpose, and to aim at it with a different sort of skill, and with a different instrumentality from that with which they chiefly work. Compel them to come in, was the method prescribed to the servants of the Lord who made a great supper, and sent out his invitations to the poor and needy. It is this compulsion we want, this earnest entreaty, this laying hold of the sinner and making him feel that his salvation is with us an object of intense desire, and that we shall be bitterly disappointed if it is not accomplished. Let me repeat some of those words. I do not want them to be missed. The conviction of the judgment is not the ultimate object of good preaching, though, if we are to judge by their manner of preaching, it is the chief, if not the exclusive end of some preachers. I would strengthen James's words. What he defined as the final goal is the chief, if not the exclusive end of most preachers today. But as he said, it is not conviction of the mind only that we must seek. It is the persuasion of the heart and life, the change of the heart and life, to conform to the glorious gospel of Christ, for the sinner to be united to Christ. And we must not only seek it, we must compel it. How? by being in earnest. Of course, only the Holy Spirit can make the work effectual, but we, for our part, must be in earnest about the business. James again. The secret of animation, the nature of earnestness, lie in an intense feeling of the subject of our discourse, in a mind deeply impressed, and a heart warmed with the theme discussed. All men are in earnest when they feel. By an earnest manner, then, is meant the enunciation that is dictated by a deep and feeling sense of the importance of our message. We are to persuade, to entreat, to beseech, and these modes of speech have an utterance of their own. Why is earnestness so important? James commented on what he called the silent and almost unconscious process of thought and sympathy often going on in the minds of those who are listening to the sermons of a preacher really laboring for the conversion of souls. He pictured the silent debate going on within the unbelieving hearer. Is he so earnest about my salvation, and shall I care nothing about the matter? Is my eternal happiness so much in his account, and shall it be nothing in mine? I can meet cold logic with counter-arguments, or at any rate, I can raise up objections against evidence, but I cannot stand this earnestness about me. The man is evidently intent upon saving my soul. I feel the grasp of his hand laying hold of my arm as if he would pluck me out of the fire. He has not only made me think, but he has made me feel. His earnestness has subdued me. What a thought! I, as a sinner, might be moved to come to Christ simply because the preacher shows by his earnestness, his passion, his obvious concern for my conversion. Quite a thought, is it not? I am not saying a sinner should be converted in ignorance under psychological pressure, but I am pointing out the vital necessity of earnestness. Imagine you're in a foreign land, where you cannot speak the language. I suggest you would know what a barrow boy, a beggar, or a bank robber wants you to do, and you might even do it, even though you cannot understand a word of what he is saying. What about the opposite? If earnestness is so important, what goes on when it's absent? A lack of earnestness will produce slumber. Slumber in the preacher, and as a result, slumber in the hearers. Slumber? Stupor is a more apt word. Oh yes, more hearers are asleep. Not always literally, I agree, but what is far worse, asleep in mind, heart, and soul, than most preachers would recognize, or admit, even if they did recognize it. Just as many, most preachers have developed a technique of appearing to look at their hearers, but not actually looking at them. Not a few hearers have developed a technique of appearing to be listening when they are not. And a drowsy congregation can be the direct result of a drowsy preacher. If this is disabusing some preachers, I'm glad of it. Spurgeon, nothing will avail if you go to sleep while you are preaching. Is that possible? Oh, possible. It's done every Sunday. Many ministers are more than half asleep all through the sermon. Indeed, they were never awake at any time, and probably never will be unless a cannon should be fired off near their ear. Tame phrases, hackneyed expressions, and dreary monotones make the staple of their discourses, and they wonder that the people are drowsy. I confess, I do not. As he said on another occasion, the age has become intensely practical, and needs a ministry not only orthodox and spiritual, but also natural in utterance, and practically shrewd. The solemn work with which the Christian ministry concerns itself demands a man's all, and that all his best. To engage in it half-heartedly is an insult to God and man. Slumber must forsake our eyelids sooner than men shall be allowed to perish. Yet we are all prone to sleep, as do others. In 1890, J.W. Wren warned his congregation at Providence Chapel, Bedford. A sleepy minister will send the whole congregation to sleep and confirm them in it. A sleepy minister will say nothing to awaken you. There is nothing to awaken the sleepy, nor anything to prevent those who are awake from falling into a deep sleep. Earnestness is the remedy. Charles Bridges could not have put a higher premium on it. In part quoting others, he spoke of the able minister who, when he preaches, procures attention by all possible art, by earnestness of speech, it being natural to men to think that where there is much earnestness, there is something worth hearing. For who could bring a true report of a fire, or of any extraordinary news, with a calm tone, gentle voice, or elegant expression? And can we wonder that a cold correctness in the delivery of our instructions should weaken in the people a belief of their truth, or at least of their importance? The really useful man in winning souls to Christ is he who is so penetrated with the value of the doctrines of the gospel as to persuade by the zeal and sincerity of his manners, when a less earnest mode of teaching would have failed to convince. A want of fervency in our ministrations is a serious hindrance to their efficiency. The monotonous, wearisome sound of a single bell may be almost as soon expected to excite moral impressions. People want their hearts as well as their understandings to be addressed. They want words flowing from the heart, giving power to argument by their piercing heat and penetrating force and compassionate entreaty. Impassioned pleadings. Do we seek to persuade our hearers? Do we press Christ and regeneration and faith and holiness? Do our bowels yearn over the ignorant, careless, and obstinate multitude? When we look them in the face, do our hearts melt over them, lest we should never see their faces in rest? Do we, as Paul tell them weeping, do we entreat them as for their soul's salvation? This is how James broached the subject. An earnest ministry. How can the work of the ministry be accomplished? Every view we can take of it replies, only by earnestness. Every syllable of the apostle's language in 2 Corinthians 5 verse 20 replies, only by earnestness. Every survey we can take of human nature replies, only by earnestness. Every recollection of our own experience, as well as every observation we can make of the experience of others, replies, only by earnestness. This is what we want and must have if the ends of the gospel are ever to be extensively accomplished. An earnest ministry. Spurgeon, as we have seen, was another who could not speak more highly of earnestness. Although he did not match James with a book, Spurgeon devoted at least an entire lecture to the topic. Listen to him. If I were asked, what in a Christian minister is the most essential quality for securing success in winning souls for Christ, I should reply, earnestness. And if I were asked the second or third time, I should not vary the answer, for personal observation drives me to the conclusion that as a rule, real success is proportional to the preacher's earnestness. Both great men and little men succeed if they are thoroughly alive unto God, and fail if they are not so. Spurgeon expanded on his theme. We must be in earnest when actually engaged in preaching. To get in the pulpit with a listless air is most censurable. Moreover, for the sake of church members and converted people, we must be energetic For if we are not zealous, neither will they be. The world will also suffer if we are not fervent. We cannot expect a gospel devoid of earnestness to have any mighty effect upon the unconverted around us. One of the excuses most soporific to the conscience of an ungodly generation is the half-heartedness of the preacher. If the sinner finds the preacher nodding while he talks of judgment to come, he concludes that the judgment is a thing which the preacher is dreaming about, and he resolves to regard it all as mere fiction. The whole outside world receives serious danger from the cold-hearted preacher, for it draws the same conclusion as the individual sinner. It perseveres in its own listlessness. It gives strength to his own transient objects, and thinks itself wise for so doing. How can it be otherwise? If the prophet leaves his heart behind him when he professes to speak in the name of God, what can he expect but that the ungodly around him will persuade themselves that there is nothing in his message and that his commission is a farce? Yet again, be interested yourself, and you will interest others. Do you wonder that they do not listen with all the ears when a man does not speak with all his heart? William Romaine used to say it was well to understand the art of preaching, but infinitely better to know the heart of preaching. The heart of preaching, the throwing of the soul into it, the earnestness which pleads as for life itself, is half the battle as to gaining attention. And again, the class requiring logical argument is small compared with the number of those who need to be pleaded with by way of emotional persuasion. They require not so much reasoning as heart argument, which is logic set on fire. Cold logic has force, but when made red hot with affection, the power of tender argument is inconceivable. When passionate zeal has carried the man, that is the preacher, himself away, his speech becomes an irresistible torrent, sweeping all before it. Brethren, we must plead. Entreaties and beseechings must blend with our instructions. Any and every appeal which will reach the conscience and move men to fly to Jesus, we must perpetually employ. But, as Bridges warned, our earnestness must be real. A painted fire may glare, but will not warm. John Angel James made the same point. If we are not intensely real, we shall be but indifferent preachers. We cannot, like the actor, have a stage dress and character to put on for the occasion, and put it off when the curtain drops. If we do, we shall be hypocrites, literally so. Nevertheless, actors can teach us a thing or two. Although a machine will be line perfect, it takes an actor to infuse emotion into the words. I am not, I hope it goes without saying, asking for an actor in the pulpit. I confess play-acting, playing a part, is a very real temptation for us as preachers. We dare not succumb to it. We must be sincere. Nevertheless, the illustration stands. Both the actor and the preacher have to communicate with those who sit before them and move them. The actor does it for the occasion, for money, applause, and fame. How much more should the preacher want to communicate with those before him? He does it for the glory of God and the everlasting good of his hearers. But how does he communicate? He must be in earnest. As I've observed, no actor would dream of carrying a script with him. It would only come between him and his audience, and thus ruin what he is about. So must the preacher be aware of it. David Garrick, the famous actor, replying to a preacher who wanted to know why he, the actor, could move men, while he, the preacher, could not. Here lies the secret. You deliver your truths as if they were fictions, but we deliver our fictions as if they were truth. But Spurgeon was another to caution against play-acting. Earnestness in the pulpit must be real. It is not to be mimicked. The best piece of acting is but acting. Those who only look at appearances may be pleased by it, but lovers of reality will be disgusted. What presumption! What hypocrisy it is by skilful management of the voice to mimic the passion which is the genuine work of the Holy Ghost. We must be in earnest in the pulpit, because we are earnest everywhere. We must blaze in our discourses, because we are continually on fire. Zeal, which is stored up to be let off only on grand occasions, is a gas which will one day destroy its proprietor. Nothing but truth may appear in the house of the Lord. All affectation is strange fire, and excites the indignation of the God of truth. Be earnest, and you will seem to be earnest. A burning heart will soon find for itself a flaming tongue. To sham earnestness is one of the most contemptible dodges for courting popularity. Let us abhor the very thought. Affection, not affectation. Affectation is evil. Affection is what we want. But sincere affection, not playing a part. Spurgeon preferred a listless, monotonous spirit in the pulpit, if real, to a masquerade of earnestness. But of course, what he really wanted was a true earnestness. Our ministry must be emphatic, or it will never affect these thoughtless times. As he said, to continue fervent for life, we must possess the fervor of heavenly life to begin with. Have we this fire? We must have the truth burned into our souls, or it will not burn upon our lips. Do we understand this? The doctrines of grace must be part and parcel of ourselves, interwoven with the warp and woof of our being. And this can only be effected by the same hand which originally made the fabric. Then came a pointed question. Have we the holy fire which springs from a true call to the ministry? What a question. What's the answer? Well, and if we have the fire, how best can we show our earnestness? This takes me to the next point.